Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I'm your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Blame It on the Russian Twitter Bots show. And as always, we have an explanation. We do not simply pull these titles out of thin air, although many times it sounds like we do. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. Now with me, first of all, not with us today is the UK Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips.
Vanished.
Yeah, but here to hold down the fort while Rick is out from the University of Kentucky, Physician Assistant Program Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And in Rick's absence, we would like for RickBot to tell you how to access our show on the web.
To get the audio of the show, go to WMKY.org. It's pretty simple. That's the Moorhead State Public Radio website. Health Matters will show you a list of the most recent shows. Click on the link and you can re-listen to the show. After that, get involved in the conversation through Facebook. Facebook.com/HMRadioshow. Facebook.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late, vaccinate. The all-natural way to take care of infections without all those artificial antibiotics or vitamins. That's right. Vaccination is the natural way to train your body's own immune system to manage those nasty viral and bacterial illnesses. You could not have a more natural way. It's like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. And, of course, we are talking about influenza vaccination. It is time to get your flu vaccine. October is the peak month. And, in fact, we have already had a fatality due to influenza in the state of Kentucky. But the vast majority of us will be exposed to influenza more commonly in January and February. That's the peak flu season. And we want to make sure that we have plenty of immunity at that time. So I always recommend to my patients, October is a good time. You can still get it November, December, even January, but the longer you wait, the less benefit you get from it. If you go too early, then in February, March, your immunity starts to wane. So it's a real guessing game, but I recommend October as a nice median time to get your influenza vaccine. Flu caused 80,000 deaths, according to the CDC, in the United States last year, including 180 children. That was the highest number of childhood deaths for a non-pandemic influenza season ever. So this was a particularly nasty flu, a particularly ineffective vaccine, I think around 30% or so effective. We were hoping to get more than that from it. We can do better, and this year we will do better, and we recommend you get the flu vaccine this year. We'll talk more about that in our second fractional portion, but that's our sponsor, the Vaccination League. Do not be late. Vaccinate. One more time, I am plugging the Lung Force Expo in Prestonsburg, Kentucky. That's on December 7th, the Pearl Harbor Day, Jenny Wiley State Resort Park. I will be there talking about lung cancer. Other actually informed speakers will be talking about things that they know something about. It will be a great day for health professionals, for lung health patients, and for their caregivers to learn a little bit more about how we can take care of our lungs. That's the Lung Force Expo. It's at Jenny Wiley State Resort Park on December 7th, 2018, an all-day event. We move on to our Health Matters Hottie of the Week. That is the hero of today's youth. We call that the hottie. This week's Health Matters Hottie is former Attorney General Ben Chandler. Ben Chandler is now the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky president and CEO. And Chandler has decided to try to focus the efforts of the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky on eliminating cigarette-related cancer and illness and disability. He said Kentucky is the cancer capital of the nation, and we do have the nation's number one cancer rate. He says it's fairly simple how you get people to stop smoking and to stop dying of cigarette-related issues. We can do something about it. One solution, to raise the cigarette tax. The legislature bumped it by 50 cents a pack last session, but we were hoping for a dollar a pack because 50 cents a pack is something that tobacco companies can absorb and won't pass on to the consumers. Now, we have a real problem in this state. Our tax is low enough that the convenient marts and the merchants along the state's borders are making an excellent living selling cigarettes to people from other states. Our cut-rate cigarettes propel the economy of some of our border counties, and for that reason, a lot of people in our legislature are reluctant to raise the cigarette tax very much. They do not want to harm businesses in their region. the bigger problem is that while you may make some money from this or from other drugs and other things that cause human misery, the long-term results do not justify the short-term profits.
Yeah, if those counties had to pay for the care of these individuals, it'd be a different story.
Yeah, and so this requires leadership and courage because it is economically not the best thing for the counties that are along our border in the short run. And so far, we haven't been able to find that courage to make that change. Every other state in the country's done it. That's why our cigarettes are cheap, is because all the states around us have already done this, and they are now benefiting from the better health and the lower rates of cigarette smoking. Again, we're tops in the nation in cigarette smoking. We're number two right now, but we're always number one or number two. And we do it because we keep the cigarettes cheap where people can get started. And then the second thing is an indoor smoking ban. Once again, that is, for many people, that is big government and a difficult row to hoe trying to get that legislation passed. But Chandler's been working on that. He said, if we were to enact smoke-free laws throughout the state, we'd do a lot to reduce smoking. We're trying to do it community by community, but only five of Kentucky's 120 counties have comprehensive smoke-free laws. And I'll tell you, my big concern about this, I've talked with the tobacco control people about this some. They feel that we can go county by county, community by community, and gradually build up some very good, strict smoke-free laws. My concern is once the wealthier communities and the more educated communities pass indoor smoking bans, and they have, then there's no incentive for them to continue to make sure that it actually goes statewide. So I am concerned right now that once again, Kentucky is dividing itself into a wealthy Kentucky, an educated Kentucky, and a poor and uneducated Kentucky, and disparity in health and the disparity in living conditions between the two will simply get bigger rather than smaller. Worry about that a lot. That is our Health Matters Hottie, and now we have 6 minutes to talk about Twitter bots.
Hey, speaking of bots, this Rick bot's pretty creepy. Is he going to be gone for a while? I mean, are we stuck with this thing?
So after he announces our website, he just sits there and just stares at you, you know, and you think, you know, I don't know. He's not really alive. He's not really dead. I'm going to unplug him.
that would be wise.
Rick's hard enough to take alive. But let's talk for a minute about Twitter bots. And you know, I mean, I know nothing about Twitter bots. But here's the reason. This was in the August 23rd Washington Post. Researchers found that bots and Russian trolls mentioned vaccines more often than the average Twitter account over a three-year period, but for different reasons. The Russian trolls stoked the debate by tweeting pro- and anti-vaccine messages in an apparent attempt to sow division, while bots that spread malicious software appeared to use anti-vaccine messages to attract clicks. So there are two things. One is you'll get this bot that will say, here's evidence that the vaccine causes hair loss in supermodels. And you think, oh, I got to see those bald supermodels. And you click and you get malware. But the other thing is they will try to create a divisiveness that, frankly, is not present. So the vast majority of Americans agree vaccines are a good thing. They train your immune system. We have been doing this now for half a century, and we've gotten pretty good. Yes, there were some vaccines that were not as good, but the ones we are using now, influenza vaccines, pneumococcal vaccines to prevent pneumonia, the new Shingrix vaccine, which is much better than the previous vaccines to try to prevent shingles, these are really good, strong vaccines. The idea that on the internet that these vaccines somehow are still linked to autism, those people won't give up on that even though it's been completely disproven, or that there's some other ailments that vaccines are linked to. Some of that then is coming from these Twitter bots. This one said, only the elite get clean vaccines. What do we normal people get? David Broniatowski, who's an engineer at George Washington University, looked at Twitter bots. And he said, you know, that's not the normal vaccine approach. You can just see there, you know, Larry says, yeah, it's the elite people getting vaccine. Everybody goes, Larry, no, that's not the way vaccines work. So apparently they shut that down. But you can tell that's not a U.S. sentiment that nobody in this country says that. So you can tell some of this stuff, again, is coming from outside this country, from people who are not familiar with our culture and with our problems and are just trying to sow discontent by any method possible. Anti-vax accounts mounting attack on American public health. It's not really out of design. It's pretty rare. I mean, certainly there were some election irregularities in the Twitter bots, but they mentioned only one out of 550 tweets by Russian trolls touched on vaccines. So This is not an organized campaign. It did peak, though, September 2017. There's one disease expert calls for white genocide since most vaccine deniers are white.
Okay. So that's their business model. Okay.
I mean, those are pretty obvious. That's a Russian troll.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. There were more vaccine tweets after President Trump announced Robert Kennedy Jr. was heading a new commission on vaccines. Again, Kennedy Jr. Feels that vaccines are not helpful and was going to prove that. That commission actually never met, but there were a number of tweets coming out that looked suspicious. The other point they said, when you're trying to fight misinformation, you know, you say, look, I'm going to lay out the facts. Well, on the internet, you can't lay out the facts.
Mm-mm. No.
That does not work. We trust the internet. I mean, we go to Wikipedia. We look things up on the internet. It gives us reliable information. And so whoever can put the most information out may win the battle. Whether or not it's good information, whether it's right or not, they could easily mislead somebody just by sheer volume.
Or if it's entertaining information.
Right. Again, the ball supermodel idea. And this was just a minor attempt to sow discord. But I think the point is, you know, we need to make sure we're getting reliable information. And just simply searching for something or simply looking at Twitter streams or looking at volume of information, unfortunately, I think is repeatedly misleading us. And we've got to, I think, recognize again the value of face-to-face communication with people that you know and you trust rather than clickbait on the internet. We're going to take a break and let you ruminate on that. We'll come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hi, this is Shelley Irving, and welcome back to the second fractional portion.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Blame It on the Russian Twitter Bot show. Again, surprising to me, and the Vaccination League is sponsoring the show, so we wanted to point out that the Russian Twitter bots not only caused some changes that altered the course of the election in 2016, but they also just obliquely attacked, and in a very bizarre way, attacked vaccination with their ideas of white genocide because the whites get the vaccines, or with the idea of elite rich people vaccines. They're the only ones that get the good vaccine. So we decided to name this the Blame It on the Russian Twitter Bot show. This is one of the reasons I think Health Matters is not the show that it should be, is that Russian Twitter bots have interfered with our communications.
Yes, there's one sitting here with us right now.
We unplugged the Rick bot, and you instantly feel like the studio is really a more welcoming place. Our sponsor for the second time, Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late. Vaccinate. Vaccination like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. That's right. This gives you an opportunity to train your body to handle viral infections and bacterial infections the all-natural way, the way it was supposed to, rather than relying on these chemicals that we introduce. And you take an antibiotic, it's going to kill everything in sight. And that can lead to problems with diarrhea. That can lead to overgrowth with funguses and germs that you don't want. If you are at death's door, if you have a serious infection, you certainly should take the antibiotics as directed by your healthcare provider. But if we can minimize the antibiotics, that means that you're allowed to keep the germs that make you healthy, and we can target your immune system to take care of the bad germs. It is so much more precise. It is so much more natural than antibiotics and vitamins and things like that. It's just a wonderful idea that, unfortunately, some people have taken the wrong way, including the Russian Twitter bots. That's our sponsor, Vaccination League. It is flu vaccine time. Your flu vaccine options. Standard flu shot.
Okay, good.
Yeah, garden variety, peanut butter jelly, take the flu shot. High-dose flu shots for older people, over age 65. Because your immune system is not quite as strong, they have a high dose, which contains a little bit extra of the stimulus that you need to get your immune system going. They also have something with an adjuvant for older people. I've not given that.
I haven't either.
Once again, for older people, it has the flu vaccine, but it also has not just a higher dose, but it also has a separate chemical that stimulates your immune system a little bit. You've got shots with virus grown in cell culture. We're not using eggs anymore for all the virus. You can still take any of these, even if you're allergic to eggs, but there are some that are specifically grown in cell culture if you had a life-threatening reaction to eggs. Shots using recombinant vaccine, essentially they make the part of the virus that your body needs to recognize the virus. I guess that's the one I should give people who say, I got the flu shot and I had the flu all winter. It's a little bit more expensive.
No flu in it. Yeah.
Yeah, no flu actually in it. But then there's also the flu mist, the nasal spray. That is a weakened virus. And the advantage of it, one, is you don't have to have a needle. And the second thing is, by being in the nasal passageways, it actually beefs up your defense against even allowing the virus to get into your system in the first place. Your body doesn't have to wait for the virus to get into your bloodstream before it starts. It can start as soon as you inhale the virus. It starts working on it. Ages 2 through 49, if you have an intact immune system, that is, you're not a transplant patient, you're not on rheumatoid arthritis drugs or things that might affect your immune system. So there are a lot of options. The big two that I'm using is the standard dose flu shot for people under 65, the high dose flu shot for people over 65. That's easily 90-95% of what I'm doing at the clinic.
What do you think about the nasal one this year? Because they took a year off. You just going to wait and see how it does? Or
yeah, interesting enough, we talked about it. The CDC says we think that they went back and they retested and they reformulated, and the CDC says we're satisfied. We think this works. We'd like to. We recommend it again. Their advisory committee on immunization practices said 2 through 49 intact immune system. You can get that nose spray. The American Academy of Pediatrics says we don't think they've proven their case, and we are not recommending it. So there is a divergence of opinions. I don't see any reason not to. It was an odd thing. It is set up to work. The evidence showed it didn't work very well the first two seasons they used it, and so that's when the CDC called a halt on it. But they've gone back and they've done some additional data collection, and it looks like it works, but the American Academy of Pediatrics is just not convinced yet.
Yeah, I have a 9-year-old son, and we're going to get the traditional shot this year and just see how things go with the nasal.
Okay. If your child will take a shot, it's great. Now, if your child
brave.
Yeah, but if that's going to be traumatic to your kid, then this is recommended by one of the two groups and would save you a needle. So we will let people make up their own minds individually, because there is a divergence of opinion
regarding
the flu mist nasal spray.
And we're not going to ask Rickbot what he thinks.
No. Rickbot can just stuff it. Deaths in the United States from influenza. I've got a couple. 2011, 2012, there were 12,000 deaths. 2012, 2013, 56,000. And what they do is they go back and look at where people have said, this person died of influenza, it's on the death certificate, or during the peak of flu season, a person who dies of respiratory infections or pneumonias is also, with certain qualifications, considered to be an influenza death. And so 12,000, 56,000 during 2011-12 and 2012-13, but the 2017-18, 80,000. And so you can see, it varies widely and nationally. And so, the virulence of that flu, the seriousness of the flu season, really you cannot tell as it starts what it's going to be like. But we got ourselves into a mess last year with an especially virulent flu season. Speaking of a mess, well, not so much of a mess, but I'll just mention this. The European Journal of Cardiothoracic Surgery on July 24th, 2017, published an article about dogs and cancer. And on October 2nd, the 19th World Conference on Lung Cancer, we'll talk more about that in a minute, also talked about a trained dog being able to distinguish between lung cancer and benign pulmonary nodules. So the publication back in July last year, they had a 3-year-old crossbreed between a Labrador Retriever and a Pit Bull. This came out of Spain. And this dog looked at 390 samples of gas collected from 113 individuals. They exhaled the gas, and the dog looked at it. There were 85 patients with lung cancer, 28 controls. 11 of those had no lung cancer, and 17 were completely healthy. A total of 785 total, 390 samples 113 individuals, and total of 785 sniffs. And it recognized lung cancer around 95% of the time when there was lung cancer. The sensitivity they call 0.95. And it was it rarely missed on somebody who didn't have lung cancer. The specificity on that was 0.98. That's pretty good, 98% specificity. So a well-trained dog, according to them back in July 2017, can detect the presence of lung cancer in exhaled gas samples. Now this, Shelley, you may remember we talked about this dog. This is Blatt the dog, who lives in Barcelona, I think, and is able to sniff these samples and diagnose lung cancer. So on October 2nd at the 19th World Conference on Lung Cancer, once again, the Hospital Clinic of Barcelona, Spain, presented their evidence on Blatt. And this was 30 patients with indeterminate pulmonary nodules, 25 of those subsequently identified as early lung cancer. And the dog, once again, was up over 90% accurate. In total, the dog was introduced to 90 samples of exhaled gas from people with the nodules, 372 samples from people without nodules, 10 times to each sample of the pulmonary nodules, different combinations of normal people breathing, and the dog, out of a total of 900 attempts, it got the right answer 879 times. 97% sensitivity, 99% specificity. This is as good as any kind of a machine, an x-ray or whatever, is Blatt. Now, they said trained dogs can accurately identify a nodule in the lungs as being cancer. I don't know about trained dogs, but Blatt can. Blatt is the one dog that's been able to do this. Yeah, we don't have a stable of dogs that have done it. We have Blatt.
Well, and it sounds like it was pretty dichotomous, right? So they either had it or they didn't.
Yeah.
So I wonder how Blatt would do if there were a lot of confounding.
Well, it's a good question. This is Alain Tremblay, who's professor of medicine at the University of Calgary in Alberta. He said, well, now, let's think about this. First, there's a trainer in the room with a dog. Mm-hmm. And the trainer knows which sample is the positive one. He said that. I don't know. I did not know that, but he said that. And you can imagine if the trainer doesn't mean to do it, it's not a trick. They're not deceiving us. But if the trainer knows which one's positive, there's going to be a little bit difference in the trainer's response. Dogs are very, very sensitive to that sort of thing. He says maybe he's getting the cue from the trainer. The other feature, they don't have to figure out what smells like cancer. All they got to do is figure out which one smells different than the other. So what if we took a person who had pneumonia and an old person who had emphysema and a person who was coughing up some thick mucus and a person with sinus condition and so forth, not just lung cancer or normal, but rather people who had other pulmonary conditions, black lung, silicosis, asbestos, and so forth. How would the dog do for them? We don't know. Five samples at a time. That's not really the way we do it. When we screen for lung cancer, we're doing CAT scans. We'll do 20 or 30 in a day, and we do them every day of the week. So this dog would have a full-time job, and they tend to get tired after a while. You can't have the trainer in the room and so forth. So the dog success rate is usually much lower than it is for studies when they have people who are off the street and have completely normal lungs. And so I don't know about Blatt. I don't know about dogs and scanning for lung cancer. And, you know, the original point, you remember, you and I talked about this. What if the dog said you had cancer? What are we going to do with that?
Right. How do you document that? How do you bill for it? How do you...
Yeah, and do you believe it?
Yeah,
if the dog points, all of a sudden the dog goes stiff at attention and points directly at you, are you going to... Is that enough? Are you going to go ahead and file your advanced directives and start your chemotherapy because a dog picked you out?
And then are you going to use the dog as a pre-screen to decide who you're going to scan?
Now, that's a fascinating idea. Breathe on the dog. Okay, you're in the left lane. You're in the right here, you know. And the right lane leads to the CAT scanner.
Well, yeah, and would you trust that even?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we are, right now, we trust the internet, and we've just presented evidence that the internet contains certain elements that are trying to mislead us. I'm surprised. I don't know that I would trust a dog. I even if Blatt is doing this great job of finding these things, even if I'm absolutely amazed, if it was someone I loved and Blatt all of a sudden stiffens and points it to somebody I love, I'm still not sure I can do anything with it.
Yeah, I'm not either. And yeah, I don't trust it. And then it instills doubt either way. So the dog says you have cancer, you don't trust it. Well, now do you want to scan just to prove it right or wrong?
Yeah.
You know,
I've read where there were some large rats that were used to diagnose tuberculosis. And again, they line this rat up and they put a bunch of samples in front of it. And the rat has a very exquisite sense of smell, and they can diagnose it faster than we can culture. Now, since then, we've moved on. We're better at diagnosing tuberculosis. We don't need to culture it for 6 weeks. But at the time, that was actually better than the best we could do, which was to put it on a plate and let it grow for 6 weeks and see if it grew. So that would represent an advantage. I don't know where BLAT fits in the world of diagnosis of lung cancer. And I'm concerned that there have been several publications about this one dog rather than us training up an army of dogs that are going to go out to the public or to the nursing homes and somehow I figure out who needs help and who doesn't. And again, I better stop there. Service dogs, therapy dogs, all those, that's a wholly different thing. But to diagnosis dogs is entirely different, and especially about something as life and death as lung cancer. I'll tell you what does work for lung cancer is cats.
Cats.
Cat scans.
Oh, wow.
So here's, we know from the U.S., there was a national lung screening trial in the U.S. that if you get a CAT scan without you don't have to have the dye injected or anything, you simply get you lie down on the scanner, lie down in the scanner, and they scan it. It takes 30 seconds, and then the radiologist looks at it. We can cut the rate of dying from lung cancer down by 20%, and BLAT has not saved anybody's lives yet. He's just, it's a kind of a proof of principle. They further found that the overall death rate, not only just the death from lung cancer, but the overall chance of dying of anything dropped by about 7%. And that is a massive swing in your ability of dying from getting a CAT scan of your chest. Now comes a second study, also from this same World Conference on Lung Cancer. This was in Netherlands and Belgium, and it showed an even bigger reduction. In males, the risk of dying from lung cancer was reduced by 26% in the people who got the screening with a CAT scan versus the ones who did the control. And in women, there weren't as many women, but the reduction was 39% to 61%, depending on how many years you follow them, their risk of dying of cancer. And it was very similar to what we did in the U.S. They picked people ages 50 to 74. We went 55 to 75. More than 10 cigarettes a day for more than 30 years, and that turns out to be around 40 pack years. We talk about a pack a day for so many years being a pack year. We did 30 pack years. They did 40 pack years. We did 55 to 75. They did 50 to 74. And they found pretty much the same thing. 7,900 people went to the screening arm. 7,800 and change went to the control arm. They received a CAT scan at baseline 1 year later, 2 years later, and then 2.5 years later, and they dropped the mortality by around 26% for men, 39% or more for women during the course of the study and afterwards. And they did that by finding the cancer at an early stage.
Now, is this better for just a certain type of lung cancer or all lung cancer?
All lung cancers.
Okay.
The good news is, too, in the United States, the way they had it set up, they picked up a lot of little dots and things that weren't of any importance. Especially here in Kentucky, we have histoplasmosis. It makes small spots on your lungs about 4 millimeters in diameter, and they don't amount to anything. We have since changed our protocol to try to not pick up so many little tiny dots that didn't matter and focus on the bigger ones that are more likely to be lung cancer. They said, here's what they said, 27,000 screens performed, only 9% were indeterminate, only 2.3% required a referral for a repeat scan. So this did not overwhelm their healthcare system. People were not being wrongly diagnosed or worried about follow-up scans right and left. They, in fact, got their numbers down low. At St. Clair, we've been doing this with the bigger, looking for the bigger nodules. We've got it down from 40% to around 13 to 15% people getting called back or having additional testing. So it turns out we can do lung cancer screening, find the lung cancer at an early age, cut down on the cancer mortality, cut down on the overall mortality. We now have two large studies that show this. The abysmal thing is our screening rates, you know, around 80 or more percent of women get mammograms to screen for breast cancer. Our colorectal cancer screening rates are up over 70% now. Our lung cancer screening rates are still well below 5% of people who are eligible. Cigarette smokers, 55 to 75, who've been smoking for 30 years a pack a day and have quit less than 15 years. If we could get to those people, we could save hundreds of lives in Kentucky alone.
That would be good. Do you think, based on some of these studies, the indications for those scans will change? Because it's picking up so few?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think we may change and expand the age group or the qualifications. That'll be a slow go. You know what happened with colon cancer screening is, if you're over age 50 and you have a problem, it might be constipation. It might be a little achy abdominal pain. We go ahead and screen you for colon cancer because we would screen you anyway. If you had no complaints at all, we'd do a colonoscopy. So colonoscopy now is the first stop for any type of abdominal complaint or stool complaint because we're looking for cancer and we're finding it. I think in the same way, we need to make the CAT scan the first stop for a pulmonary complaint. You got a cough? Let's screen for lung cancer because we could save your life. You feel more short of breath? Let's screen for lung cancer because it could save your life. These are the type of changes we're going to have to make, really a sea change in the way we approach pulmonary complaints to try to get our screening rates up. Because there are a lot of lives at stake, especially here in Kentucky, where we lead the nation in lung cancer deaths. Almost 3,500 a year, Kentuckians die needlessly because we cannot control the cigarettes and we cannot screen for lung cancer at the rates we should. We also cannot go on with our second fractional portion. We're going to take a break and come back and finish this show. Why don't you do so as well on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of health care professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hi, welcome back. This is Shelley Irving, and this is the third fractional portion.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Blame It on the Russian Twitter Bot show. Once again, we are talking about information and misinformation, particularly as it relates to vaccination in general in our society. The internet is not a safe place to get information. And I'll tell you, for health information in general, you've got to know your sources. You could get some malware at the worst. At the best, you could get some misinformation. If you go to the National Library of Medicine, you go to the CDC, if you go to a .gov site, you're going to get the best information. These are pretty far away from the politics of the United States. These are mostly scientists employed by the government, and their job is to make sure it's accurate. And they are held responsible for their content, whereas other people are trying to sell you something or just trying to get you to click on their sites, and they will be much more sensational. So please choose your sources carefully. Avoid the Twitter bots if you can, and also those people who are just trying to get you to click on their site or sell you something, and choose reliable sources of information. We ourselves encourage you to go to your healthcare provider. We think that they know your individual condition better than we on the radio or anyone on the internet. Take that information in and run it by them and make sure that you're getting the best advice you can for your health. Our sponsor for the final time, the Vaccination League, Don't Be Late Vaccinate, the all-natural way to take care of infections without artificial antibiotics or vitamins. It's like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. And one more time, we are talking standard dose flu shots, ages 18 through 64 years, can get it with a jet injector.
A jet injector?
Yeah, it just shoots it through the jet so fast that it gets it under your skin. Sort of like a paint gun, except not nearly as painful. I mean, the nice thing is you don't have a dirty needle because you don't have a needle.
So is that the kind you got?
No. I've never seen a jet injector for this, but I've seen those things. You know, they're pretty neat. 18 through 64 jet injector, but the rest of it, we just take it's really a pretty small needle. Not a big deal. And given into a muscle, standard dose flu shots for those up to age 64. High dose flu shots, 65 and older. It just has more of the killed virus in it. Your immune system has more to look at, more of a chance. You are old. Your immune system is rolling out of bed, trying to get active and start fighting off infections. And you say, look, let's just give it a little bit more flu virus, the killed flu virus, and see if it won't work harder.
Is that the one you got?
No. But I give a lot of that because I do take care of a lot of older people. Then there is a shot made with an adjuvant. I haven't used that also for older people. And it sort of gives you the flu virus, and then it pokes your immune system with a stick. It says, hey, you know, wake up, get out of bed, go fight this flu virus. So you can either just give it more virus, more kill virus, or you can give it a normal dose of virus and a stick. That's okay. The two flu shots for older people.
So which one's better? Which has more effectiveness?
You know, the one we're using right now is a larger volume. Adjuvants are kind of a new idea. Shingrix vaccine for shingles is a brand new FDA approved in February of this year. A shingles vaccine. It's a two-stage vaccine, and it has, first of all, a recombinant vaccine. Remember, that means that there's no virus, actual chickenpox virus in it, but there are parts of chickenpox made with recombinant technology. Plus, it has one of these immune stimulators, one of these adjuvants, they call it. And it has done wonders in the clinical trials for your ability to fight off shingles. So that's called Shingrix. Our problem is, at least here in Moorhead, at least when we were recording this show, it is darn hard to get your hands on. It is back ordered for most of our pharmacies, and they do not have a date when it will arrive, but hopefully by the first of next year. Do not take the old Zostavax. The CDC says that probably should be, it should be in the trash can. It's just not that good a shingles vaccine. A lot of my patients have had Zostavax, and they still get the shingles. I mean, no vaccine is perfect, but this vaccine is a little less perfect than the rest of them. Whereas Shingrix, that's the new one. It is a two-step vaccine, 6 months apart, and it has the adjuvant. It may hurt your arm a little bit more, but it will do a far better job at preventing shingles. As a matter of fact, they've studied it prevents about 90% effective in preventing the nerve pains of shingles even 4 years after you get it. And that's as far as they've looked at it so far.
And you get it one time, and as far as we know, it's good forever?
Yes.
You don't have to revaccinate?
That's right. Two shots, 6 months apart, one and done. The big problem right now is you can't find it, or at least, like I said, at the time we go to press, you can't find it. Hopefully, they'll be getting it into area pharmacies soon. But do not take Zostavax. You hold out for the Shingrix. It looks to be a much better vaccine.
Can younger people get that if they've had shingles?
Yeah, it's recommended, because shingles is so hit or miss. We don't know why it happens. Everyone who did not get vaccinated for chickenpox has had chickenpox. And so the virus is hiding there in the nerve cells in the spine, and it for some reason will break out. And certainly if you get a kidney transplant or something like that and you go on immune suppression, that's a likely time for it to break out. But the vast majority of my patients, I don't know why it happened. It is more common and also more serious as a person gets older. So we're setting right now, the CDC says after age 60. If I'd had a bad case of shingles when I was younger than that, I might go and see what I could work up for it. But right now it is recommended for people 60 and older. Shingrix vaccine, a two-step shingles vaccine, replaces the old Zostavax one step. And we do not recommend Zostavax anymore, nor does the CDC and their Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. But that's a separate thing. That's a shingles vaccine with an adjuvant. There are flu shots with an adjuvant. And I think adjuvants to try to stimulate a stronger immune response are going to be more common in vaccines in the future. There is also the flu mist is back. This is a weakened virus that is in a nasal spray. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices of the CDC says, yes, this is fine. They've done some additional work, and we believe it works. The American Academy of Pediatrics says, we're not so sure.
Yeah.
And Shelley says, we're not so sure. She is not buying the flu mist, has returned, and is okay and safe.
The needle version has worked just fine for my family.
That's true.
So
it's good enough for my, it wasn't good enough for my grandmother, because my grandmother didn't have influenza vaccine, but it would have been good enough for my grandmother, so it's good enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, fair enough.
If it's not broke, why fix it?
Well, okay. Our sponsor, the Vaccination League, don't be late, vaccinate. All right, Shelley. This was October 5th, 2018. The San Jose, California Police Department used heart rate data from a murder victim's Fitbit to determine exactly when she died and to capture the man charged with killing her. This was a New York Times article on this. A coworker found 67-year-old Karen Navarra dead in her home September 13th. She was wearing a Fitbit activity tracker. Her heart rate spiked around 3:20 p.m. on September 8th. Then it rapidly slowed, and it stopped at 3:28 p.m. 8 minutes went from a spike to stopping.
And she had the Fitbit on the whole time.
The last person to see her on that day was her stepfather, Anthony Aiello. He's 90 years old. Now, she's 67, wearing a Fitbit. He's 90, okay?
Okay.
He said, I stopped by the house to drop off some food. She was fine. I left. I don't know what happened. So, the investigators obtained a search warrant. They got the Fitbit data. They noticed she was wearing it, so they got the data from the Fitbit.
Okay.
They figured out the exact time of her death, which was between 3:20 and 3:28 p.m. They went to her doorbell video surveillance footage, and the car he had driven was still there when her Fitbit stopped.
Okay.
Bloodstained clothes were found in his home. And so, I mean, this is, first of all, this
bad.
Yeah, this is going to be, you're going to see this on NCIS. I mean, this is just too good a story for it not to be on a TV show. Her Fitbit pinpointed her time of death. Her surveillance camera showed his car in front of her house at the time the Fitbit stopped. After explaining, and you can imagine, there's this moment in the interrogation room. Sergeant Joe Friday walks in, right? And he says, I'm going to tell you this week. He explained the Fitbit, its ability to record time, physical movement, and heart rate. And Mr. Ayala was informed the victim was deceased before he left the house. I mean, they had the film, they had the Fitbit, they had the times, they synced them up. Mm-hmm. Her heart had stopped. His car was in front of the house. And this one, this is, you know, and you always wonder what happens at those moments when all of a sudden you realize all of your alibi, all your defense that you built up is just evaporated. After questioning Mr. Ayala, the detectives left him alone in the interview room, and their microphone recorded him repeatedly saying to himself, "I'm done. I'm done. I'm done."
So what was the cause of death?
That, I don't know. I'm not sure how this 90-year-old man killed this 67-year-old. Again, a spike in the heart rate. It indicates a struggle, you would think.
Right.
And apparently he, I don't know, I guess he could have.
Blood involved?
Yeah, so, I don't know. Well, there were bloodstained clothes.
Yeah.
So it is a struggle and possibly then a knife or gunshot wound that bled out and her heart stopped then. You know, I think we're just starting to tap into the capabilities of these monitoring devices. Kind of astonishing. Again, they not only knew that her heart rate stopped, but they also knew that it sped up.
Do you think that we'll go through a period, though, where this is going to be kind of like the early era of DNA testing, where you're going to have some false information because something was wrong with the Fitbit or the Fitbit? I mean, the Fitbit isn't qualified as a, you know, medical device.
I hear you. I think, though, I mean, we, in this case, they knew exactly how to use it. There was, yeah, you know, there was not any hesitation at all. I need to know.
They had the video footage. So what if they wouldn't have had the video footage?
Yeah. And then we'd have.
That goes to trial. What?
Well, actually, we could pinpoint exactly when her heart stopped. But as far as when the fatal blow occurred, it could have been before that. Again, she could have lived for a while after that. But it was pretty clear she was stopped before his car left. Now, he said, well, you know, maybe I went around back to check out something. But he said, I'm done. I mean, that was as close as you get. You know, and the old murder mysteries, the guy would always say, yeah, I did it, and I'm glad I did it. I'll tell you why I did it. She was trying to blackmail me, and I'm going, you know, look, shut up. this is not helping your case at all. Why are you just laying things out? But this guy, I mean, that I could just see him there, you know, oh, boy, I'm done. I am done. Realizing that he just absolutely got nailed by that Fitbit. I think using it that way, I think having more data, I mean, you know, now virtually every crime story has that person that stays in the main office and just stays on the computer all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I need somebody like that. You know, somebody who just stays on the computer all the time. And I will call them from time to time and say, look, can you find out if Shelley has left the office yet? Check all the surveillance cameras within a 3-block perimeter, and let's see if she's left the office because I remember something I wanted to show her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this guy, he's all over the computer. I mean, he knows passwords. He's hacked into the FBI satellites and stuff like that. And, you know, when he's not tweeting about vaccines, he can determine your whereabouts and help me out.
Or managing the Russian Twitter bot. that's sitting in the corner that looks like Rick.
I just feel like I need that person. I mean, because you can see, I mean, we're going to technology now. And if you do watch the murder mysteries, which I do, by the way.
You do.
Well, my wife is a big, big NCIS fan.
Okay.
I'm not, you know, there are a lot of theories on that. You know, one is that
concerned you were about that.
No, I mean, they're reasonably well written, but they all have now, they have a computer expert. If you don't have a computer expert on your crime team, if you just have a bunch of burly people who can, you know, can do martial arts, you in fact, you are behind the times. At this point, you've got to have that computer specialist or you do not have an advanced team. It would help to have a forensics expert. Most of them have a forensics expert, plus the computer guy, mm-hmm. plus the burly guy that knows martial arts. Or growl. I mean, it could be a man or woman.
They do that in, I would be interested to see if they didn't have the video footage, how that plays out in a trial.
So whether or not a Fitbit, in fact, well, you could...
I mean, they got the order to get the information from it.
Her heart rate suddenly increased, and so we knew... that she recognized the person, you know, as someone that she was worried about or something like that. There was this period of time, apparently they were talking and their heart rate kept increasing and her blood pressure went up and so forth. We're not sure exactly what was going on, but there must have been a discussion going on. I mean, how much can you infer from a person's vital signs is the question.
Right.
If you don't have the video surveillance. And again, all they knew was his car was there.
Mm-hmm.
He might still have been able, if he had been saying I'm done over and over again, he might have been able to concoct some scheme where he was also selling candy to the neighbors, you know, going door to door to raise money for the PTA or something like that.
And how accurate is the Fitbit in a situation like that? You know, I mean, if you shake it, you can add a bunch of steps to it. So.
Oh, I see. So what you do is you reset the Fitbit and prove that the heart was still beating when you left. Wow.
Well, I wasn't going to go there with it. I was just, you know, if I'm on a jury, how do you prove to me that that Fitbit information is accurate, clinically accurate?
Mm-hmm. So instead of him just saying, I'm done over and over again, he's saying, I need a computer forensics expert on my team to prove that Fitbits can be reset. Because someone hacked her Fitbit. And made it look like I'm the killer.
You are a conspiracy theorist, aren't you? You enjoy that.
Well, it's the Twitter bot show.
That's true. The Twitter bots reset the Fitbit. That's what happened. There's the alibi.
Now, here's the, you know, you have managed to talk yourself out of that vitamin D study, which you wanted to talk about because we don't have enough time.
Yeah, I need like 2 hours
so
to talk about
we
that.
Will save your vitamin D rant for next time. I will tell you one thing that's kind of interesting. June 27, 2018, the most Googled health problems by state. I saw this republished. Kentucky's most Googled health problem, hepatitis A.
Hepatitis A, makes sense.
Yeah. Now, if you look at Georgia is syphilis. Ohio was syphilis. Tennessee was strep throat. And finally, West Virginia, porn addiction. That are the most Googled health problems of us and the state surrounding us.
Yeah, I think
meanwhile,
I'll take Hep A.
Thanks to our Moorhead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook at HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these tips on how to teach your children to limit their health matters listening. Although research on this topic is still limited, recommendations for all parents include step back and think about your relationship with health matters. Are you using it as a stress reliever instead of taking a walk or deep breaths? Are you sometimes purposefully withdrawing into health matters away from difficult family interactions?
Think about what aspects of health matters stress you out the most. Save these for a time when your family's not around so they don't feed off your stress.
If you want to create times to stop listening and single task on your family, prioritize mealtimes, bedtimes, and other downtime with your children.
Remember that children watch and copy their parents, so they are learning how to listen to health matters even when parents do not realize it.
Avoid behaviors you don't want your kids to have. Listening to health matters while driving or ignoring someone else calls for your attention while your ears are glued to the radio.
Resist the urge to photograph, document, and post your health matters experiences.
The more we parents demonstrate this type of tech life balance, the more Rick will be annoyed. To learn more about the advantages of putting down health matters, go to our Facebook page. But whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.